Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If so, congratulations, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have tons of cool features like curated podcast playlists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but my brand new, members-only version of this show, called Morbidology Plus, is only available on the Himalaya app. When you become a member of Morbidology Plus, you'll get all ad-free, exclusive episodes where I'll be covering topics we normally leave out on my free episodes. You'll even get these episodes a full 4 days early. And the best part is, Morbidology Plus is available for just $4.99 a month. For all those reasons, Himalaya is the only listening app that I use, and I'm sure it'll be the only one for you too. So download Himalaya and go join Morbidology Plus today. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Just as families across the world were settling down to celebrate Easter Sunday with their loved ones, a brutal crime scene was being discovered in Fresno, California. East Park Circle Drive was an affluent neighborhood in Southern California. The $500,000 homes were well kept and their gardens well manicured. The murder stunned the community and highlighted the fact that violent murders were not limited to Fresno Skid Row areas. It was a bloody reminder that even in your own expensive home in a safe and quiet neighborhood, you too could become a victim. Dale Yule, his wife of 30 years Glee, and their two children, 24-year-old Tiffany and 20-year-old Dana, lived in a sprawling ranch house at 5663 East Park Circle Drive, Southern Fresno. They were a close-knit but private family. Dale was president of Western Piper Sales Incorporated, which sold aircraft for general aviation and also serviced airplanes. He had studied at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, where he earned a degree in aeronautical engineering. Before moving to Fresno in 1962, Dale had worked for Douglas Aircraft in Long Beach. Those who knew Dale said that he was reserved and always drove a hard bargain in business. Next, we will hear from Craig Hannadel, author of Catch Me If You Can, A California Saga of Murder.
He was a great salesman. He'd barnstorm into farmers' fields and sell them on the 200 mile an hour and the wind in your face and the glamour of it. He sold a lot of airplanes. He was making as much as $30,000 per airplane in the 1960s.
Dale was a strong-willed businessman, but he would always help a friend out in need. James Dempsey, a Fresno attorney who met Dale at a function for private pilots, said that when he was having airplane engine problems, Dale flew him to where he needed to be. Dale also owned a 160-acre pistachio farm in Planada, Merced County, a 160-acre fig farm in La Grande, Merced County, and invested in stocks and bonds. Next, we will hear from Dale's brother, Richard.
Dale was sort of a self-made man, very dedicated, personable, loved his family. They're very close.
Glee was a former teacher and assistant director of the Fresno Regional Foundation. In 1957, she received a bachelor's degree in international management from the University of Arizona. And then in 1973, she received a teaching credential from the Fresno State University. Glee was a kind and compassionate woman who donated countless hours of her time to volunteering and community service. She was affiliated with the Valleys Children's Hospital, was a member of the State Medical Quality Review Committee, and was a former member of the State Bar of Governors. She had campaigned for a Fresno school bond measure to the Junior League to the State Bar Board of Governors. It was here that Glee met Nancy Clinch, a Nevada city attorney who was also a member of the board. Clinch described Glee as straightforward, sharp, analytical, and warm. Quote, "She took people under her wing. Every time I saw her, she would ask about my daughter and how she was doing in ballet," recalled Clinch. Next, we will hear from Dawn Fishback, one of Glee's friends.
Glee was a beautiful person. She was the type of person everybody loved.
She was one of the most well-liked people I've ever met. She was always had a smile. She was always friendly. She was always there for you. She's the kind of person, if you saw her at an event, you'd get a card or a note a week later, "Great to see you last week," and she was just that kind of a person.
Glee loved the arts, losing herself in a book and planning family vacations across Europe and other states. According to Dale, Glee was the tour director. Glee was also a cancer survivor and often spoke openly in groups and to individuals who were battling the disease. Despite the fact that she had wealth, Glee didn't flaunt it. She much preferred to order clothes from catalogues than to go out on shopping splurges. Tiffany graduated from Sam Walking Memorial High School in 1985, where she had been voted the shyest member of the class. In 1989, she received a Bachelor's of Science degree in Business and Consumer Family Studies from Linfield College in McMinnville, Oregon. She was a graduate accounting student at Fresno State University, where she had enrolled in the spring of 1991 and was a candidate for office in a student accounting club. She was said to be quiet and hardworking. Deal had always said that Tiffany's personality was shaped by a car accident she was involved in when she was a young child. A steel plate had to be installed into her head to help the wound heal.
Tiffany was a sweetheart. She's very shy. She was going to some graduate classes at Fresno State, living at home.
Tiffany was a sweetheart of a young lady, very intelligent, no known boyfriends. She was kind of on a more recluse side, not outgoing type person.
Dana was a graduate of Sam Walking Memorial High School. In 1989, he received an award in school as most likely to succeed. To those who knew him, he was competitive when it came to anything, even getting good grades. He attended Edison Computech in Fresno, which was a magnet school for gifted youths. Dana was mature for his age. While other kids wore jeans and Converse, Dana wore slacks with a tucked-in shirt and carried a briefcase. He often bragged that he could get by on just 4 hours of sleep. Michael Poindexter was one of Dana's best friends.
I went to his house quite a bit. His parents were really nice. His mom was one of the nicest people I ever knew. He was Mr. Businessman. All he wanted to do was, you know, become some, you know, world-famous billionaire tycoon. He let you know that right away. He was the greediest person I've ever met in my life. I'm in business, I meet a lot of greedy people, and he tops them all.
While seemingly professional, Dana also had a wild side. Before turning 16, he snuck off in his father's Lincoln Continental and TP'd a neighbor's home. Dana was a good student, earning almost straight A's. Nevertheless, he didn't get into his college of choice, Stanford University. According to Dana, he was the victim of affirmative action. Instead, he opted to join Santa Clara University and moved into Casa Italiana, an exclusive dorm that was more like an apartment. He juggled his time between his home in Fresno and Casa Italiana. Dale was an active member of the Sunnyside Country Club, which was just a stone's throw away from the family's home. When he didn't show up for their Easter function on the 19th of April, 1992, his absence was noticed. 2 days later, Dana called Jesse Knapp, a neighbor, and asked him to do a welfare check on his family. Dana was staying with his girlfriend's family in San Jose for the Easter holiday and said that he hadn't heard from them in a while and was becoming concerned. At around 9 a.m, Rosa Avita arrived at the Yule family home to begin her cleaning shift.
The Yule family always did their outings with their kids, and I do have other customers that I don't hear them do outings with their family. To me, it's like my family. We're very close. And since they were just the two kids, you know, Dana, Tiffany, and the mom and dad, and the grandma, you know, she would come over to the house. especially in the holidays. I mean, it was just a together family, and that's the way my family is. And I thought that was pretty cool, you know. They were happy. They weren't, you know, I don't know, how do you say it? Like, people that have the money, they really flash it out there. This family did not. Brother and sister, you know, I've never seen Tiffany or Dana fight. They were sweet together. Mrs. Yule was a very sweet person with her kids, you know, with both of them. You can see it in her. I never seen her upset. She was always smiling. She was always a happy person. That's the way I remember her. Just good people.
She said that the door was locked when she and two other cleaners arrived for their weekly house cleaning chores. Rosa had been working for the Yule family for around 12 years, so when nobody answered her knocks and she noticed that the door was locked, she used her own key, which had been provided to her by the family. She was expecting to hear the burglary alarm, but was surprised when it didn't go off when she turned the key and entered the home. Upon entering the home, Rosa knew that something was amiss. The house was always exceptionally clean, even before Rosa came to clean. Yet today, there was a stereo on the floor, some drawers were open, and there were some items strewn across the floor. Quote, "They never kept their home that way," said Rosa. She headed towards the kitchen and was met by a sight that would scar her for life. Laying lifeless on the kitchen floor, Rosa found Tiffany. Knowing all too well that this was a crime scene, Rosa backed out of the living room. As she was exiting the home to call for help, she was met by Jesse, who was just walking up to the house to check on the family at Dana's request. They called 911 and fire and paramedic crews arrived. Inside, Detective John Souza and Detective Chris Curtis discovered the bodies of Tiffany, Dale and Glee. When the family was identified, it was announced that Dana had been out of town when the bodies were discovered. He had been contacted by the sheriff and subsequently rushed back to Fresno. Immediately, locals began to speculate that this was a robbery gone wrong. Over the past year, there had been an influx of robberies in the area. However, Fresno County Sheriff Steve McGarrion was quick to announce that the murders were not linked to the spate of robberies. Just 2 weeks earlier, 42-year-old David Lee Fraser had been arrested in connection with 122 robberies in the area. At the time of the murders, he was in jail awaiting court proceedings. Furthermore, the crime scene was evidently staged to look like a robbery gone wrong and not an actual robbery.
A person that burglarizes houses that starts looking, say, at drawers, he starts from the bottom and he comes up because you never have to close a drawer that way. And so the whole dresser is left open. Where here you had different variety of some was closed and some was partially open, some was wide open. It was like someone randomly did this. I'm thinking, well, 15-year-old kid, because that's what it looked like juveniles would do. But now, juveniles wouldn't be capable of killing three people.
While authorities were quick to denounce the murders as related to the string of break-ins, they remained tight-lipped about any other possible motivations or suspects. In fact, Sheriff Steve McGarrion ordered his deputies not to disclose how the family were killed. He did state that they had all died a violent death, but refused to elaborate any further. Quote, "I am not at liberty to discuss the case because it could hinder the investigation," he said. One source close to the investigation said that the family had all been shot dead and that it wasn't a professional hit. Investigators started to piece together the final movements of the Yule family, leading up to the moment that they were killed. Sergeant Dale Caudill was the head of the homicide team investigating the murders. It was determined that the last time the family was seen alive was Easter Sunday, when they had been visiting friends and family in the Watsonville area. The family had a vacation home at Parajo Dunes, a secluded gated community running alongside the beach near Watsonville. They left Watsonville in the early afternoon. Dale flew his own plane back from the coast, stopping en route at his office at Wester Piper, while Glee and Tiffany drove 150 miles east to their home on Park Circle Drive. They were all killed shortly thereafter. Next, we will hear from Steve Elliott, reporter at the Fresno Bee.
There were no calls about shots fired. There was no calls about a disturbance or strange vehicles in the area. Nothing at all.
Sheriff Stephen McGarrigan announced that Dana, who was out of town at the time of the murders, had been interviewed twice, but was quick to say that Dana was not a suspect. He had been picked up by authorities on California's Central Coast and brought to Fresno for questioning.
I still don't know how any of this happened or how they might family died or anything of that nature. It's just dead, it's all right.
Do you know of any reason why anybody would want your family dead?
Nothing matter.
On the 24th of April, investigators finally announced a cause of death for the Yule family. They had all died from gunshot wounds. They had theorized that Glenn Tiffany arrived home first. Investigators believed that the killer was waiting inside the home. They didn't even get the chance to bring their suitcases in from the car. Tiffany had been shot in the back of the head in the kitchen as she was carrying a box of tissues and a Foster's freeze drink cup. The bullet went into her neck, right through the skull and out of her forehead. Glee was blissfully unaware since the silencer had been used. She was still talking to her daughter from inside the living room when the gunman stepped around the corner to face her. One shot missed Glee. The killer shot twice more as Glee attempted to run away. One of the bullets ripped right through the top of her right arm, just below the shoulder. It then travelled into her chest and lodged in her left shoulder. The next bullet hit Glee in her right shoulder. It pierced her spine and both lungs before exiting through the left collarbone. Glee fell to the floor before the killer shot her once more, underneath her right eye. She died in her office, still clutching her car keys. Around 30 minutes later, Dale returned to the home. He entered through a rear door, carrying newspapers and mail, and began to walk down the hallway. The killer was waiting inside a bedroom, and as Dale walked past the bedroom, the killer stepped out behind him and shot him once in the back of the neck. The bullet travelled through Dale's neck and out just underneath his right eye. The killer had picked up all of the shell casings. Detective Chris Curtis describes the scene.
There's a little dining room off the kitchen, and Tiffany's body was lying on the floor there. She was face down with her hands underneath her. Through the dining room, there's a hallway that goes towards the garage, and that's where Dale Yule's body was found.
The victims apparently did not struggle, and the killer most likely knew the layout of the house. This, of course, led many to speculate that Dana was behind the murders. The fact that he was apparently out of town at the time of the slayings was much too convenient for some locals. Dana's alibi for the weekend was that he was at the vacation home with his family on the Saturday night. His girlfriend's family had joined them for dinner. The following day, he bid farewell to his family and went to stay with his girlfriend's family in Morgan Hill.
Sunday morning, I played tennis with my dad and we had lunch. We all took a walk on the beach. I was the first one to leave. And my mother and sister and father were all there and we all, hugged and said kiss and said, okay, we'll see each other in 2 weeks.
Investigators quickly confirmed that Dana's alibi had been verified. Dana's girlfriend's father, John Zent, was an agent for the FBI, and he confirmed that Dana was with them over the Easter period when the murders had taken place. Quote, he was never a suspect. As part of our investigation, we have talked with him, and many others who knew the Yules, stated Sheriff Stephen McGarrigan. Following the murders, Dana went to stay with relatives living nearby, and they all rallied around him for support, especially Dale's brother, Richard.
Well, I was shocked. We rallied around Dana, concerned about this poor guy who had just lost his whole family. We were at my brother's house, trying to gather and make sense of all this and wait to see what happened.
The crime scene was still active, and crime scene tape cordoned off the lavish home. Media assembled around the home, trying to catch a glimpse of the crime scene investigators doing their job. Quote, it's important that we don't rush our investigation. There's a lot of evidence in the house that still has to be processed, said the sheriff. Now that investigators had pieced together the final day of the Yule's life, it was still unknown how the killer entered the home. They still had no suspects or any kind of motivation. Investigators were looking into the family's personal and business relationships to see if anybody had a grudge on anybody in the family, but they kept coming up empty-handed. While the crime scene was still being analysed to see if there was any evidence that could lead to a person of interest or suspects, investigators asked the State Department of Justice's crime laboratory technicians to assist, but did not ask the FBI for help. However, Dana's girlfriend's father, who was a San Jose-based FBI agent, offered his services on his own time. The funeral for Dale, Glee, and Tiffany was held at the First Congregational Church. Around 400 people showed up to pay their final respects to the much-loved family. As classical music emanated from the Red Church, mourners sat silently on their pews. Dana and a number of other relatives entered the church through a side door and took their seats in the front pews. Reverend Frank Baldwin led the service. He remembered the family fondly. He described Glee as the ultimate giver. Quote, "She lived life to the fullest and had a special love for her family." He recalled how Dale was a hard-working man and a gentle giant who always had a smile for those around him. And Tiffany. He recollected that she was a, quote, "delicate flower just ready to bloom." Towards the end of the service, the Reverend pondered about what happened and why. He told the mourners that it wasn't wrong to feel fear and asked them to pray that the case be solved. It was noticed during the funeral that the caskets were unusually cheap. Afterwards, the family were buried during a private family service at Belmont Memorial Park. Dana wiped away tears as his father, mother, and sister were lowered into the ground. Investigators soon started to look deeper into Dale's business associates.
He was known as an honest, strong businessman. He expected people to do what they promised. Some employees claim that they're dissatisfied, but he paid well. He was very demanding.
There were a lot of people who had to be looked at to see if somebody wanted him killed.
Dale's tough deals often left him the target of angry customers. In fact, there were several customers that had filed lawsuits against Dale, accusing him of overcharging and even cheating them. Just the day after Dale was murdered, James Glidewell from Arizona filed a lawsuit in Fresno County Superior Court, alleging that Dale had charged him $1,700 for work that was never carried out, and that Dale would not release his plane. There was also two lawsuits from Frank Lamb, who had employed Dale from 1965 to 1972. In 1972, Lamb had gone to prison on charges of conspiracy and illegal transportation of marijuana. During his stint in prison, he had left Dale in charge of his business. However, while locked up, Dale had established his own business, Western Piper Sales Incorporated, and with him, he took the exclusive rights to sell Piper aircraft in Fresno. Dale had won both lawsuits. Lamb had his own theory on the murders, telling the Fresno Bee, quote, "Dale Yule did not respect you or thank you for anything you had done. My theory, and it's just a theory, is that he stepped on somebody and he didn't care who he stepped on." There were a few other lawsuits against Dale that painted him as a man who often found himself mixed up in disputes. In 1982, Dale's company convinced two men that the best price Western Piper could get for their airplane was $21,000. However, according to court documents, Dale sold the plane 8 days before for $23,500 and kept the $2,500 for himself plus a commission. It wasn't known how this lawsuit ended up, but Dale later sued the two men for illegally recording a conversation with him. Then in 1978, a lawsuit claimed that an airplane managed by Dale's company had been flown an additional 800 miles, but the measured flying hours had been tampered with to make it look like less. In this lawsuit, the plane's owner won. There was also a similar allegation which surfaced during a criminal trial in federal court in 1987. It was a massive drug smuggling trial, and a defense attorney claimed that equipment tampering showed that Western Piper was involved in drug smuggling. George Carter, the defense lawyer for the alleged smuggler, Robert Irving Barnes, claimed his client was not guilty of stealing an airplane to smuggle cocaine and marijuana, and instead tried to point towards Dale and his business as being involved. He claimed that Dale had allowed smugglers to use his planes for a hefty fee. The judge ruled that Carter's allegation was fabrication and that they could find no evidence that any payments had been made to Dale. So to say that there were a number of unsavory characters in Dale's life was an understatement, but could any of them hate him enough to kill him, as well as his wife and daughter? Quote, "We're talking to everybody within the sphere of influence, and in this particular case, that sphere of influence is very large, so it's going to take a while," said Sergeant Margaret Mims. By this point, the pressure was on the Sheriff's Department. Numerous people were calling up and looking for an update on where the investigation was and whether there were any suspects. By week two of the investigation, police admitted that they still had no suspects in the murders. Sergeant Dale Caudill said that they were still in the process of interviewing friends and business acquaintances. The following week, a $25,000 reward was offered for anybody who could provide police with information that would lead to a conviction of the killer or killers. The reward was announced by Dowling, McGarrigan, Phillips & Aaron Incorporated, a Fresno law firm that was handling the Yule's estate. If you hadn't guessed by now, Dale and Glee were exceptionally wealthy. They had an $8 million estate. Their estate executor, Michael Dowling, said that nobody in the family would be making a comment about the murders or the reward. However, he did say that Dana and the rest of the family were completely grief-stricken and had been cooperating fully with police. In fact, Dana would match the reward, taking the total up to $50,000. Every single day in the United States, hundreds of thousands of people have to make big decisions about their health. Treating diseases, managing pain, it can be scary, and even more daunting, it can be life-changing. But what happens if you're offered a so-called miracle cure, but then you end up worse than before? If you're like me and listen to Wondery's Dr. Death, then you've already heard about the 33 patients in Texas who went in for surgery and had their entire lives transformed forever by an incompetent doctor. Well, it was host and reporter Laura Bale who broke that story wide open for the world to hear. And now she's reporting on another important story, stem cell therapy, and a bad batch that gave a group of patients disastrous results. The new podcast, Bad Batch, investigates the multi-million dollar under-regulated industry of stem cell therapy, where greed and desperation can often collide, resulting in disaster. It is an industry that claims to treat pain, autoimmune diseases, infections, and even autism. It is a cautionary tale and a very important listen. I've already binged the 6 episodes that are already out and cannot recommend it enough. You can subscribe to Bad Batch on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening now. I've also included a handy link in the description of this episode, so go and check it out. As you all know, I'm always on the hunt for awesome podcasts to listen to, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about a show that I'm excited about. If you're a fan of Morbidology, then I think Invisible Choir will be right up your alley. Invisible Choir examines the most heinous murders through investigative storytelling, primary source audio, and victim testimonials, with the goal of bringing a voice to the voiceless and visibility to the invisible. If you like the show, make sure to check out their premium channel on Himalaya, where you can find all episodes ad-free and 24 hours early, as well as exclusive content and a members-only community group where you can chat with the host. Simply download the Himalaya app, search Invisible Choir, and enter promo code CHOIR for your first month absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go and check out Invisible Choir. I absolutely love the show, and I know that you will too. Since the police didn't release detailed information about how the family was killed, other than that they had been shot, the rumour mill ran wild. One rumour that was widely circulated was that the family had been mutilated and sexually assaulted. Locals had somehow speculated that one of the victims was beheaded and one was dismembered. In a bid to squash these rumours, Sergeant Margaret Mims read out a prepared statement. Quote, "Sheriff's detectives wish to dispel these rumours as being totally false. The investigation reveals that none of the victims were molested, nor did they receive any injuries other than the gunshot wounds that killed them." By October of that year, Fresno had already had 69 homicides. equaling the record number of homicides per year in 1990, 12 of which had been killed during domestic disputes. The Yule murders weren't the only ones to remain unsolved either. 66% had been solved, meaning that there were another 34% that had no resolution, at least not by October. 6 months passed with little to no updates from the police. However, at the beginning of November, it was announced that investigators had been looking into the possibility that Dana was somehow involved. Dana's attorney, Richard Berman, wrote to the Fresno Bee, expressing his anger and disbelief that police could even consider Dana a suspect. Berman accused investigators of, quote, repeatedly defaming Dana Yule and his reputation by leaving the impression with his friends, business associates, and in his college community that he is a suspect in this horrible crime. Dana feels that he is being scapegoated because the investigators have been completely ineffective in finding and prosecuting those responsible. If, in fact, the sheriff's office is not intending to spread these rumors, then they should make it clear on the record that Dana is not a suspect. Berman wrote a letter to Sheriff Steve McGarrion stating that Dana adamantly denied any involvement in his family's murders and that he considers the investigation and innuendos unprofessional and offensive. By this point in the investigation, Dana was back living in his family's home and had taken over his father's business. He was receiving benefits from a trust fund and would take possession of his parents' estate in installments. Then when he turned 35, he would obtain the entire estate. There had been a clause in his parents' will that he was completely oblivious to, which would limit his access to the assets until he turned 35.
Well, it turned out there was no burial arrangements in the will. So Dana said, well, what about the money?
Dana learned that he would inherit, but not until years later, not until he was 35, that the money would be in a trust.
Well, Dana went ballistic. He jumped out of his chair and slammed down his fist. Why would my dad do a thing like that? Well, you know, I was shocked. At first, it's one of those things when you hear it, so I didn't hear that, did I?
Everybody in the room just sort of looked at each other. It was like, why is that the reaction? I mean, when your family's just been murdered.
By this point, however, Dana had received property in cash worth $500,000. Among those assets was a 1989 Mercedes, $8,700 worth of furniture and appliances, a diamond worth $7,555, and numerous pieces of artwork, one of which was worth $6,500. He was also named administrator of Tiffany's estate, which was $310,000. Investigators had spent a good amount of time looking into Dana's background. He had a keen interest in the so-called Billionaire Boys Club. The club consisted of young Californians who wanted to make a fortune in investments. However, the club had ended when members of the club were involved in two highly publicized murders. In fact, Dana had even wrote a letter to the club's founder, Joe Hunt, who was in prison for robbery and murder. Dana had appeared in a San Jose newspaper where he described himself as a self-made millionaire. In the 1990 article, Dana was described as a teen mogul, apparently selling mutual funds and converting a bankrupt airplane dealership into a multi-million dollar business. In the article, Dana claimed that he had internships at several large brokerage firms in Seattle and New York. The piece was written by Shelby Grad, and Dana had showed him an air freight business in San Jose, which he claimed he owned. However, he refused to take him inside. There was another article in the 1990 Santa Clara University yearbook which read, quote, by the time he was a high school senior, the company he had formed had grossed over $2.7 million, making freshman Yule one of the youngest and most successful entrepreneurs anywhere in the United States.
It's believed that Dale may have cut Dana off after these articles came out.
Dale would not stand for something like that. We're wondering if that was a time that Dale told Dana, I'll help you through school, which is one more semester than you're on your own.
Now, of course, everybody that actually knew the Yule family knew that this was complete fabrication. Western Piper was owned by Dale and Glee. Neither Dana or Tiffany had any ownership stake in the business. Furthermore, the State Department of Corporations and Fresno County property records indicated that there was no companies under Dana's name. Inquiries at the National Association of Securities Dealers also turned up nothing. The fact that Dana was evidently jealous of his parents' success and wanted to emulate their wealth set alarm bells ringing for the investigators. Dana had always been obsessed with money. As a young boy, he carried around $100 bills and made friends by offering to pay for lunch at school. While other kids caught the bus or had their parents pick them up, Dana would order himself a taxi. In high school, he had few friends because all he ever spoke about was money. In college, instead of hanging posters of women in his dorm, like most teenagers, Dana framed a photograph of Michael Milken, who had been sentenced to 10 years in prison and fined $600 million for racketeering and securities fraud.
Dana Yule had a small Mercedes, and he went over to the coast and he wrecked the car, and his father obtained an exact replica of that car, same color, same year, same interior, and actually took the blame for the accident so that Dana wouldn't have to tell people he was involved in the accident.
They were still looking at Dana as a person of interest, at least, and investigators were traveling to Washington, Utah, Southern California, and Santa Clara to chat with his friends and acquaintances.
Is there anybody that would want your parents dead?
Want them dead?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can think of specific people. My sister is the most harmless creature in the world. I don't think she's ever offended anybody. I mean, and my father, you know, he's a pretty calm person most of the time. Once in a while, he gets upset at somebody or like a lawsuit or employee. My mother's very political minded. She's in the state. Was in the state bar, board of governors. Had a lot of political power.
Yeah, I have a question. Did you have anything to do with your parents' death?
No.
They had found out that just the day after the family's funeral, while most people were grieving, Dana hitched his father's ski boat to his mother's Jeep and headed to Millerton Lake with a group of friends and a keg of beer. As a matter of fact, a few people had noticed that Dana was acting extremely peculiar at his family's funeral. Dale's brother, Richard, in particular.
The funeral, he acted like he was a host of a social event. Laughing, very inappropriate, pretty gross.
One person in particular that they wanted to speak to was Joel Radovich, who had lived in the same dorm as Dana. However, in early 1991, Joel and two other students were charged with stealing almost $4,000 worth of furniture from the dorm. According to court records, the charges were dropped after the school was reimbursed. Joel left Santa Clara after he graduated with a business degree, and investigators were now unable to track him down. Early on in the investigation, they had tracked Joel down, and he claimed that he didn't really know Dana too well, and that he had been at an auto body shop when the murders were taking place.
We aren't really tight, but we're just friends. We like to kick it together. Other than school, we didn't communicate outside of school.
Who were you in there?
Watching TV, moving cars and all. So I was there probably most of the day.
But what time did you go home?
11? 11-ish?
Following the interview, Joel disappeared. Further investigation uncovered that Joel had lived with Dana inside his parents' home after the murders. He had also taken helicopter lessons along with Dana, and Dana had purchased himself a $100,000 airplane.
He downplayed his relationship with Dana Yule. By the way he described it, you would think they were more of acquaintances.
As the winter months began to disappear, so did the number of investigators working on the case. By April of 1993, Detectives John Souza and Ernie Burke remained working the case full-time. They still hadn't tracked down Joel, but managed to speak to his lawyer, Terry Wolfe, who said that his client just wanted to stay out of the public eye and that he had spoken to investigators early on and given them a full statement. According to Wolfe, Joel wasn't a suspect and had only been interviewed because he was friends with Dana. He also said that Joel wasn't hiding and investigators couldn't find him simply because they weren't searching hard enough. With the 1-year anniversary approaching, Dana issued a statement which read, quote, "On April 19, 1992, four wonderful lives ended in tragedy. My father, my mother, and my sister were brutally murdered. My world was shattered and my life was changed forever. The reality of a loss like this can hardly be imagined, even after this length of time. I must say that this tragedy has been deepened by those in the media who have spread gossip and innuendo, which was unsupported by fact or distorted reality. Those reporters who have been inaccurate or sensationalist in their stories are doing a disservice to the public, my family, and me." One of Dana's most staunch supporters was John Zenth, his girlfriend's FBI father. In a letter to the Fresno Bee, he said, quote, "The concept that Dana hired someone to do this crime is really grasping for straws. Perhaps it isn't apparent, but Dana is a victim. He has lost, in one crime, all of his immediate family." In November, there was finally an update in the case when it was announced that investigators had a warrant to search Joel's home in Canoga Park. In order to get a search warrant, investigators needed to convince a judge that there was a reasonable cause to believe that they would find evidence of a crime. Apparently by this point, investigators had begun to speculate that Dana had paid somebody to kill his family in order to acquire their estate. While this appeared as though there would be a breakthrough in the case, that breakthrough didn't come until just over 2 years later, after sheriff's officials met with prosecutors to lay their case. In March of 1995, Joel Radovich was arrested for the three murders. He was held without bail and denied any involvement in the slayings. Shortly thereafter, Fresno County Sheriff's deputies issued an all-points bulletin for Dana Yule. They had anticipated arresting him at the family home where he had been living. However, he was spotted speeding away from the home in his tan Mercedes. He was believed to have been armed with a semi-automatic rifle. 2 days later, however, Dana handed himself in to authorities in Long Beach and was transported to a jail in Fresno. In addition to Joel and Dana, 26-year-old Jack Ponce of San Bernardino was arrested and charged with providing the gun that was used during the murders. Jack's father, Ernest Ponce Sr., was quick to announce that Jack wasn't involved and he had reported his gun stolen. However, shortly after his arrest, Jack admitted to providing the weapon to Joel and gave a detailed account of the murder and directed them to the barrel of the gun, which had been hidden in Southern California.
Were you aware when you bought the gun of what it was to be used for?
No, never. I never knew that he was going to do anything like that with it. He just said that the mother was facing him. So he shot him more times than once. And then he said, maybe he shot the daughter once when she turned a corner in the back of her head. And then he waited and shot the dad.
The arrests capped the extensive 2.5-year investigation. The public would soon come to learn just exactly what evidence investigators had collected over the past while. Around a year after the murders, Joel made a phone call at a payphone in Canoga Park and said things that implicated him in the murders. Quote, "I have a feeling this thing is going to blow up with Dana." In another phone call, he said, quote, "I don't want no fucking stock options. $250,000 and I want it now. I want to go around the world." There was also a conversation between Dana and Joel during which they expressed fear that one of their friends was going to talk to police and spoke about what they would say if they were arrested. An affidavit from 1994 stated that the murder weapon was an AT-9 semi-automatic assault rifle. It is a gun not too dissimilar to a Tech-9. By this point, Jack, who had taken police to the gun's barrel, had been released after agreeing to cooperate with the prosecution. With Dana in jail, there was a battle over the Yule's estate. The trust money was available to Dana at the discretion of the executor of the estate, and the money was critical for Dana to be able to pay for his defense lawyer. If Dana couldn't pay his defense lawyer, he would need to have a public defender. A subsequent court hearing failed to decide whether he could use his family's money to pay for a defense lawyer. Dana's aunt, Betty Whitted, said her nephew could use her share of the family's estate, but Betty's brothers said that they would fight this because they believed that Dana was guilty of the murders. They didn't want the Yule's money being used to defend somebody they believed had killed them. It was the first time that anybody in the family had publicly accused Dana of the murders. However, Dana's defense lawyer, Richard Berman, said that the only reason his uncles were saying that he was guilty was because they wanted to keep the inheritance money for themselves. Eventually, the judge sided with Dana's uncles and ruled that Betty could not provide money from the Yule's estate to fund Dana's defense. With no money, Dana's defense lawyer stepped down and a public defender was appointed. As the prosecution and defense were preparing for trial, some more evidence came forward. In a bid to commit the perfect crime, Joel had shaved his head and body to avoid leaving any hair behind at the crime scene. While waiting in the Yule's home to ambush them, he sat on a plastic sheet. Joel had gone to the house before dawn so that no neighbours would have spotted him, meaning he waited there for around 12 hours. After killing the family, Joel stayed in the home until after nightfall. This information had all come from Jack, who had provided Joel with the murder weapon. In the wake of the murders, Dana spent at least $160,000 of his grandmother's money on himself and Joel. Dana had been made trustee of his grandmother's finances and began spending just the week after his parents and sister were killed. The preliminary trial for both Dana and Joel began in September of 1995. Peter Radovich, Joel's brother, testified that he had helped Joel attach silencers to a gun and then dispose of the gun parts. Peter had welded a washer onto the barrel of the gun so that a homemade silencer could be placed on it. According to Peter, he never asked Joel what he was doing with the gun or why he wanted a silencer on the gun. He also said he couldn't quite recall who had asked him to dispose of the parts of the gun, along with tennis shoes, a small plastic pipe, and cut-up tennis balls. The AT-9 had been disassembled and Peter and Jack Ponce had driven 45 miles, dumping pieces of it along the way. Jack Ponce also took to the stand. He described how Joel had confessed to the murders and said that he and Dana would be splitting the family's $8 million fortune. However, while at first, Joel seemed cool and collected, when investigators began digging deeper into Dana's friends and acquaintances, he lost it. He started to worry that he had left a glove behind at the crime scene and debated fleeing to Mexico. Apparently, Dana had paged Joel, urging him to get as far away as he possibly could. Jack also testified that Joel had worried about life after death, fearing that he would go to hell if God did exist. In return for Jack's testimony, prosecutors agreed not to press charges against him. A judge ruled that there was enough evidence for Dana and Joel to go to trial. In December, the Yule family's possessions were sold during an auction. Both those with a morbid curiosity and those looking for a good bargain clambered into the Yule's home and rifled through their drawers and closets. Some eyed up the floorboards and carpets to see if they could figure out where exactly Dale, Glee, and Tiffany had died. The auction was overseen by Jack Barthelm, who confessed to the Fresno Bee that he had considered using the murders as a marketing ploy, but ultimately decided against it. Among the items sold were Tiffany's collection of Barbies and Kens. The trial finally began in December of 1997. Philip Cherney was defending Joel Radovich, and Peter Jones, Michael Castro, and Ernest Kinney were representing Dana Yule. Jim Opliger and Jeffrey Jammer Schmidt were prosecuting the case. In opening statements, Deputy District Attorney Jim Opliger said that Dana and Joel had one thing in common: the desire to be millionaires by the time they turned 25. Quote, "All murders have a motive, and in this case, all other motives will be eliminated, save one, financial. Joel Radovich, while committing an act that's costly, received no direct financial benefit. The only way he can receive benefit is to get a payout from his crime partner," said Deputy District Attorney Jim Opliger. He laid out the case, detailing how Dana had given Joel the family house alarm code and told him where to find 9mm ammunition in the home. According to Dana's defense lawyer, Joel had committed the murders, not with Dana, but instead with, quote, other creeps from LA. He said that Dana had no reason to kill his parents. They had given him a Mercedes, expensive clothing, and access to around $100,000. Quote, maybe Dana was spoiled by his parents, but he appreciated them, said defense lawyer Ernest Kinney. He pointed towards other potential suspects, zoning in especially on Jack Ponce. He claimed that Joel and Jack had committed the murders, believing that there was a safe in the house. David Ackers, one of the first paramedics at the crime scene, testified, quote, we immediately evaluated her for signs of life and found none whatsoever. The body was stiff with rigor mortis. Captain James Hart testified that another paramedic found the body of Dale and then the body of Glee. They said that when it was evident that it was a crime scene and not just a terrible accident, they backed out and waited for police. Dr. Michael Chambliss, the pathologist who conducted the autopsies, detailed the last moments of Dale, Glee and Tiffany's lives. He described how Dale's spinal cord had been severed by a bullet and that he probably only lived for a few seconds and managed a few shallow and gurgling breaths. He said that Tiffany, who had been shot once in the back of the head, died almost instantly. For Glee, she was the only one who knew what was coming, and those last moments must have been absolutely terrifying. She had been shot in the arm, the back, the chest, and underneath the right eye while the killer was standing above her. The jury heard evidence of $33,000 worth of helicopter and aircraft flight training that Joel took, most of which was paid for directly by Dana, and the rest with $100 bills that the prosecution said came from Dana as payment for killing his family. When Joel's father, Nick Radovich, took to the stand, he testified that he didn't give Joel any money and that Joel didn't have a job. So where exactly did the money come from? The jury heard how a gun cleaning kit was found in Dana's apartment in 1995 and had Joel's fingerprints on it. They also saw dozens of financial documents that linked Dana and Joel, including checks and automatic payments.
Dana was giving Joel money. We actually have photographs of them leaving the bank together, getting his Mercedes and driving off together.
Why is Dana giving Joel Radovich $5,600 to learn how to fly a helicopter? I mean, that's pretty good money. We're all speculating why he did it, because he's probably paying for the murder.
Who else? Who had insider information? Who stood to benefit? And why leave all the phony clues except for to point away from the obvious?
During the investigation, Dana and Joel had been under surveillance. During trial, it was revealed that on the night investigators told Dana that they believed Joel had killed his family, someone paged Joel from a payphone near Dana's college.
He starts to shut the door. And I said, by the way, we think Joel Radovich killed your family. He looked like somebody punched him in the gut. He didn't turn white, he turned transparent. So after we told him at his dorm that Joel Radovich was responsible for killing his parents, he makes a page to him. I mean, again, you don't have to be a rocket scientist.
The investigators knew this because they had Joel's pager cloned.
Detective Souza obtained a pager that was identical to the one that Joel Radovich was wearing. And so when Joel Radovich would get a page, Detective Souza would also get that page.
I didn't even know you could do a clone pager, you know, but it made perfect sense.
One of the detectives immediately drove to the payphone and saw Dana holding the receiver. This wasn't the only instance of the two communicating after investigators had told Dana that they believed that Joel was involved in the murders. There were several instances of them talking on payphones. During one phone call, Joel said to Dana, quote, they either have the phones tapped or I think snitches. Someone is running around listening. I figure they've got a tap or something.
Statements like, well, you never know what they hold. You know, evidence. Don't talk to them. I'm worried. Can they arrest me? I mean, why do you make those statements? Unless you're Gilly.
Fresno Sheriff firearm expert Alan Bordreau testified about the AT-9 rifle barrel that was dug up from a field that Joel's brother directed him to. He said that once he had cleaned the dirt and rust from the gun, he examined it and determined that the bullets that killed Dale, Glee, and Tiffany had been fired from that gun.
They were very distinctly marked in a very odd way. And it suggested to me that those bullets had been fired through a weapon that had been modified perhaps with a silencer. My opinion was that those bullets from the murder came down that barrel dug up from the earth.
Dana's love for money was at the root of testimony throughout the trial. There were several people who testified that Dana was obsessed with money and obsessed with people believing that he was successful and wealthy. His best friend in high school, Michael Poindexter, said, quote, "He's the greediest person I've ever met in my life." According to Michael, Dana would have done just about anything to acquire more money. After 3 months of testimony, the trial was coming to an end. It was at this moment that Dana's lawyer, Ernest Kinney, said that it was Jack Ponce who had committed the murders alongside Joel. According to Kinney, Jack had been, quote, "fueled and heated by the devil." Other than this, he didn't provide any evidence that could possibly connect Jack to the murders. It was Dana who had been throwing money at Joel in the aftermath of the murders and allowing him to stay in his parents' house. Prosecutor James Opliger pointed towards Dana and Joel and asked the jurors to convict them both. Quote, "Do the right thing and bring the killer of that family to justice. They sit there," he said, pointing to Radovich. "And they sit here," he said, pointing at Yule. He said that all evidence pointed towards Dana being the mastermind and Joel being the one to physically carry the murders out. Now it was up to the jury to decide their fate. After an astounding 11 days of deliberation, both Dana Yule and Joel Radovich were convicted of first-degree murder. With this conviction, they were both eligible for a death sentence. As it would soon turn out, the difference between life and death was one man who was firm on his verdict of life imprisonment, while the other jurors favoured death. Because of this, the jury deadlocked, bringing an end to the trial. Therefore, Dana Yule and Joel Radovich were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Dana was the epitome of evil.
I had mixed reactions to the guilty verdict. Some satisfaction that the person who killed them had been convicted, and also some sorrow, some sadness over the tragedy of this entire family being wiped out, if you will, three by murder, one by the prosecution of that murder. I guess that's been one of the big question marks that everybody has raised and nobody's been able to answer. Why do kids turn out to be that way? I have no answer.
I remember Joel looking down and I think realizing what the rest of his life was going to be like.
Following the sentencing, Dana attempted to still inherit a share of his family's fortune. State bar law forbid him from directly inheriting his family's estate, considering he was convicted of their murders. However, he fought to maintain himself as heir to their grandmother, who was going to inherit around half of the family's assets. However, Fresno County Superior Court Judge Lawrence O'Neill ruled that the grandmother was not competent to make decisions and removed Dana as heir. It was also ruled that Dana would not receive any of the $100,000 trust fund that his parents had set up for him.
It changed my life forever. It was I couldn't believe the sadness that I felt for that such evil could exist with people. I mean, it's things of fiction. And I couldn't believe it could happen to our family.
The Easter Sunday murders of the Yule family became a landmark on Fresno's crime map. It's no surprise, really. The case had all the elements of a fascinating crime story: violence and greed. They were the culmination of what happens when nothing is ever enough for somebody. Dana Yule emulated his parents' wealth, and when that wasn't enough, his greed took over. The slayings were a grim reminder that parricide not only flows from poverty and despair, but also from the privileged and spoilt children. Well, Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Candace Chambers and the True Crime Lab podcast. I'm also now on Himalaya Plus, which is practically the same as Patreon. I'm in the process of doing my very first Morbidology exclusive episode that will be available on Patreon and Himalaya Plus very shortly. I'd also like to thank everybody who's taken the time to leave a positive review or rating on iTunes or wherever else you listen, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.